Psalm Chick. You are listening to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast. This week we will be discussing and spoiling. This will be a very spoilery discussion about Inception. Christopher Nolan. I am joined by Christian Mirinki. Mirinki? I think I got that right. Christian Mirinki.
Wow. That's some subconscious you've got on you, Tom. That's quite a charmer.
I also have with me Kelly Wand. Kelly Wand, do you have a Inception-related tagline for us this week?
Do I? Yeah, here we go. Dreaming is an act of pure imagination, attesting in all men a creative power, which, if it were available in waking, would make every man a Dante or Shakespeare, except Kelly Wand.
Now, I'm assuming that that is a doctored-up, let's see, Rimbaud quote. Was I close? Sounds like something a French poet would say.
No, his name was Hedge. H.F. Hedge.
What? That's some. I've never even heard of that.
He didn't even have a first name, and he did something that awesome. That kind of sucks, in a way.
Now, Kelly Wand's
only known by his initials.
You thought Rimbo posted that?
The French one.
You mean Stallone? That character?
One of the things I've really been looking forward to since I saw Inception is Kelly Wand sort of summarizing the events of that movie. It's a multi-layered movie, and Kelly, I was hoping you could sort of just lay it out for me and other listeners. just very simply, what is the plot of Inception? Why don't you tell people what happens? And you can feel free to spoil things.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
Tell us all
the way I assumed Christopher Nolan pitched it to Warner Brothers after Dark Knight made like $1 billion.
This is good.
What he went into the meeting.
Okay.
And he was really baked at the time. So the errors are his, not mine, in grammar. Inception. So this dude, Cobb, specializes in extracting secrets from people's dreams by forcing them to dream about safes and kidnapping. So this other dude, who's Japanese, whose dream he just infiltrated in this test drive, hires him to implant, or incept, an idea in the head of this other executive named Cillian Murphy about his father's will. But they have to go three levels into the subconscious, which means he needs a crack team of dream crackers. So he gets this teenage girl, Ariadne, who always disregards his advice and makes everything blow up and gets glass in his face, to be his architect. And he gets his friend, Arthur, who's a master of free fall combat and this. And he gets a master chemist to be his driver. And Sato comes to, even though he has no training of any kind, and he gets shot 2 seconds in. Spoiler alert. So he visits his father-in-law and mentor, Michael Caine, in Paris, whose daughter he accidentally killed by making her suicidal via an inception. But Michael Caine still arranges to meet him at the airport in L.A., where he's, like, staying at Leo's house and watching his kids. And Sato's fine with this track record. I guess he doesn't know. He just takes Leo's word for it. So they get Cillian Murphy on a 747 and drug his drink, like, in Night and Day. And they get him to resolve his father issues by having him dream he has a sack over his head, and he's going over this bridge into water, while at the same time, they're blowing up an elevator, while at the same time they're assaulting a snow fortress, while at the same time Leo's telling the projection of his dead wife that they grew old together and he'll always love her. And then she stabs him in the lung with a butcher knife. Then Leo dreams he wakes up and he's allowed back in the country because Sato called airport security and said, "I bought the airline. You have to let murderers back in," just the same time. And Leo finally gets to see his kids' faces, and his daughter's name is Vanilla Sky. And his son looks older than Ellen Page. The end.
Very good, Kelly Wand.
You seem to have agonizing.
Yeah, I can imagine that was tough. You seem to have taken copious notes.
No, I just that old thing, just threw that on.
Okay, who's going to go first after that? Who wants to say?
That's me going.
All right. So you seem to have some rather approving tones in describing some of this. Like, for instance, you didn't seem as dismissive of Inception as you were, say, Clash of the Titans.
No.
Okay.
Inception's Christopher Nolan movie, and Clash of the Titans has Sam Worthington in it.
Good point.
Start there. But it was weird to see this, like, only a few months after Shutter Island. Like,
yeah,
Shutter Island is supposed to come out.
Yeah, careful, right?
Okay, all right, never mind.
I agree, but that's an area where we should tread carefully, yes. Can you say, though, Kellywan, how did you feel it compared to Shutter Island?
I think I liked it a little less than Shutter Island, but I really liked it. But it's like the poor man Shutter Island. Shutter Island is the Poltergeist, and this is the E.T. And I was more of a Poltergeist man in the summer of 80. Okay. I mean, the thing about Shutter Island was it had a lot of different characterizations in it, considering it was sort of just a movie about one thing happening. And in this, I didn't believe in any of these people, which maybe I wasn't supposed to. But even the guy in Memento, I was interested in his life.
Okay.
I'll be quiet.
I want Dingus to go now.
Yeah.
We should check in with him. Yeah, he's the smart one on the podcast.
He's being awful quiet, so he's saving up a fastball.
Fastball. He's he's the smart one on the podcast. That's what everybody thinks.
That's what we think. So yeah. Vote
you said Predators was dumb as a post.
Yeah. We're the morons who liked it.
Yeah. Well, no. What? Wait, what? Hold on.
What just happened?
I liked it?
Yeah, go back and look at the tape.
Dingus was the one who didn't like Shutter Island. So now let's predict what he's going to say based on that.
I really have no idea. This is one reason I wanted to hear your synopsis, Kelly Wand, and I'm just dying to hear what you guys thought of it. So, Kelly, I now know a bit about what you thought of it, and now I'm ready for Dingus to go. Dingus, let rip your fastball. Is that how they say sports stuff? Did I do that right?
Yeah, you really gave us the high hard one there, Tom. Good job.
Ew. What's happened to the podcast? It used to be good. JK.
All right, so I'm not going to give you a fastball, but I am going to knock the curveball that Kelly just threw right back. Mm. And say that I'm really happy Kelly brought up Shutter Island and said what he said, because I feel exactly the opposite. So he says, so what did you say, Kelly, that Inception
is the
poor man's Shutter Island. Okay, yeah.
So Shutter Island's the poor man's Inception to you.
Well, when I left, all I can think of, everything that that Shutter Island did wrong, this film did right, or to put it in a positive way, because positive thoughts are always more effective than negative thoughts, as this film taught us. that this film does all of the things right that I thought Shutter Island did wrong.
Can I give you guys a quote?
Oh, go ahead. Okay, yeah.
I just want to give you guys a quote from Inception. You ready for this? As soon as the music ends, you blow up the hospital, and we all ride the kick up the layers. That's what I wrote down.
That's a good line. There's a lot of good lines in it.
That line right there, that I think should be the tagline.
Liked when Ellen Page goes, wait, so whose subconscious are we going into again? And they're like super deep into the plan, and she's like, and I knew the answer. I was really proud, like, I'm ahead of Ellen Page, even. She's a genius who makes mazes.
She was the architect, yeah.
She's the mistress of the labyrinth.
We don't know much about these people, and I think I kind of wish I did, but the movie is just about them constantly explaining the rules of the movie, but I found those fascinating for the whole movie.
There's a lot of it, yeah. It's
all exposition.
It's an hour and a half of exposition for an hour of heist, yeah.
Yeah.
And the only thing I didn't like about it was the action. Like, I thought it was too conventional and not as cerebral as...
I'd go one further. I'd call it incompetent.
Yeah.
I don't think Nolan...
I didn't know what was going on in the snow. That's where I got... They're all taken right on the snowmobile, like, hung on by ropes. Like, that's the subconscious. That third world in a billionaire subconscious. Come on.
I
wasn't metaphysical enough for me. It felt like a summer blockbuster all of a sudden, and I resented that. Intruding.
I mean, I was a bit disappointed that it's, so I guess I'm the opposite of Dingus then, and that I hated it. I thought it was I just thought it was messy. I didn't care for. I mean, that's Kelly. You talk about the characters. It's basically about one character, not even that much about him.
And it's the same guy. It's the Shutter Island. It's like his dying hallucination in Shutter Island before he gets lobotomized.
It's kind of a spoiler, but okay. yeah, it did relate a lot to Shutter Island, but regardless, I like Shutter Island better. I would say easily.
So you there you go, Dingus.
I'm the nattering nabob of negativity.
But I definitely liked Inception more than you did, Tom. If you hated it, because I wasn't hating it.
I think it's
like when Dingus didn't like Shutter Island because he didn't think the effects it was producing were deliberate. I think the annoyingness of Inception is deliberate too, and it just hit you the wrong way.
And when you say annoyingness of it,
it's annoying. It's like a video game. Like, okay, what am I trying to do? What's going on? Level what?
Well, we've talked a lot on this podcast about rules-based movies. Some movies are more in tune with their rules than others. Clearly, Inception, the first hour and a half, is setting up to be a very rules-based heist because Lord knows they take such pains to, you know, it's so talky early on, and it's like reading a video game manual. It really is. I mean, it's like, okay, this is going to be a rules-based movie. And I just felt like most of that time, I just felt I'd made a very poor use of the movie's time and especially the actors. And I didn't feel there was enough payoff for this setting up that, hey, we're going to have this real rules-based movie, so we're going to explain all this stuff to you about the sedative not affecting the inner ear and how you can get wet and how an architect works versus a chemist. And all of that stuff, I was kind of patient during that, and I was like, okay, but, you know, I'm getting this down. I think I've got it. And it just – I didn't feel it needed any of that. I felt all of that was just a huge waste, and it certainly didn't – make I felt it didn't make the final hour any better. It didn't help me at all.
Well,
so I think I would say, just to sum up, this is, I think, a worst case scenario of a movie that's trying to be a rules based movie, and you have to do that a lot in heist movies. And I just thought it did a terrible job of that.
What do you mean that it's trying to be a rules based movie and it fails at that? Give me
well,
an example of that.
Sure, sure. I mean, later on, you know, they're setting up. I can see what they're setting up. For instance, they set up, I felt there should have been much more of a payoff, this idea of when that feeling that you're falling in a dream. And when all of the kicks come together or whatever, they show Ellen Page in three instances of falling. And that, to me, should have been the big payoff right there. And it was just kind of a quick throwaway scene, three shots of Ellen Page falling. They set up the infinite.
Wait. That's a quick throwaway scene?
I'm saying it should have been the payoff, I think. I think that they should have tied together, especially after seeing Joseph Gordon-Levitt do wire work for so long. I feel they should have tied together this concept that all the characters all feel like they're going to fall at the same time. And where that should resonate with is this confusion that people have when they're dreaming and in reality, you know, this sort of like you hear an alarm, you wake up from a dream and your alarm is going off and you've incorporated that alarm into your dream. You know, that's something that everybody can sort of resonate to and can understand.
Right.
And so there's this idea of falling in a dream that I felt would have been an amazing payoff. You know, The Matrix even touches on that, that I just felt was just wasted on one shot, on, you know, three shots of Ellen Page. You know, the movie isn't even about Ellen Page. Ellen Page exists in this movie for no other reason than for Leonardo DiCaprio to bend her ear about his dead wife so the audience can hear. I mean, one of my problems with it, too, is I just felt like in a heist movie, you need interesting characters. You need to develop these other characters, and I thought Inception was terrible at that.
I couldn't disagree more.
Okay.
First of all, I don't think this is just a heist movie. But
no.
I understand why you're interpreting it that way, but I don't think that that's the only purpose she serves.
Hyperbolic, but I think that's that's her main purpose, because we don't learn anything else about her.
There's no payoff to her skills, actually.
Yeah, they do this great. Here's another rules-based thing, Dingus, where I feel they show the rules – and then they don't do anything with them. Early on, we see this great sequence, and it's one of my favorite bits of character development in the movie, and it's telling that nothing gets done with it. We see her. Leonardo DiCaprio says to her, I want you to design a maze in 2 minutes that takes me more than 1 minute to solve. Or I forget the equation, but it even touches on this idea of different time commitments at different layers of reality. He's like, you take 2 minutes to design a maze that I can't solve in 1 minute, whatever that was. And she does it a few times, and he solves it quickly, and she gets frustrated. And then she finally makes a circular maze. Mm-hmm. And it shows that she can bend the rules. She can she can subvert expectation. We talk about that a lot on the podcast. She can subvert expectation as an architect. And that's this great bit of character development about her that I just felt went nowhere. I didn't ever see anything like that come up with this idea of her designing worlds.
She's the one who comes up with the solution, though, at the very end, after DiCaprio is thrown in the towel. She goes, no, we can still do it. You just go down one more level. Like, she's the one.
Oh, she's like a cheerleader there. I mean, what does she do? How does she, like, subvert? How does she?
She's smarter than he is. So that's what we learn about her. Who doesn't get shot somehow. She can't fight, and they bring her everywhere.
That's another example, Dingus, where we set up this idea of her subverting, changing expectation, her sort of doing an end run around the expected way of doing things. And I felt like nothing got done with that.
They give Sato the grenade and the gun, but not Ellen Page. Like, isn't she their young, nubile, agile badass?
And that's another
thing. Architect some weapons there or something? Like,
you say that, Kelly Wand, and they play with this, and this is where I felt, this is one of the parts where I felt, you know what, movie, you have set up this expectation that you're going to be rules-based, and you have Tom Hardy just show up with a grenade launcher for a quick joke.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? That's first of all, that's not very funny. Second of all, what happened to all these rules? But, you know, did Tom Hardy dream up a grenade launcher? Can they do that?
Right.
Why don't they just dream up a cadre of snipers?
Or did he do it? We don't even know what they can do.
And The Matrix is great about that, by the way. That's another thing. As I was thinking of other movies, The Matrix, in a way, is like, you know what? We're not going to get super rules-based. We're just going to do cool stuff. And that was okay. You know, The Matrix had Lawrence Fishburne doing a montage about a pill for maybe, you know, 3-4 minutes, and that was really all that it took. and this, just for an hour and a half of explaining rules and introducing characters, I just thought it was just a terrible heist payoff.
And the antagonists are all faceless, like, completely for the whole thing. Like, you don't even know why he's fighting in the hallway with that security guy. Like, he's just another random guy, but it's staged like this is the important.
That's the other line I wrote down is, what is it? Where did it go? These are not normal projections. They were trained.
Right. Yeah. But they were trained with automatic weapons. And
I mean, I get what they were going for. This idea that Cillian Murphy's character anticipated, that his company anticipated that this could happen, and they trained him for Defenders. I mean, I get the concept, but what's funny is that that's another instance. We have this hour and a half of explaining rules, and then they want to change the game this way just so they can have action sequences, which...
They did that early, though.
Right.
They tipped their hand early. You're going to see some pointless gunfire stuff.
All right, so Dingus, get in here. Let's hear what made all this work. This stuff that bothered me. Why did it not bother?
Inception apologist.
Inception apologist, come in now. Because I think that that subversion of rules is deliberate, and I think it is fantastic, because there's that moment when they're in the second layer dream. I think that's where they are. And I'm not going to pretend that I understood everything about this movie, but I flat out loved it. I mean, I jaw-droppingly loved it. And I had the moment where the dudes are suddenly closing them off in the middle of the kidnapping, and they have automatic weapons. And I'm thinking, why, what? Where did these dudes with automatic weapons come in? And at that moment, when they're in the car and these guys are shooting automatic weapons at them, I thought, my normal thing at this point, which is, well, what are the stakes here, really? Because if you get killed in this world, you just wake up. I mean, what's the point? And there's this wonderful progression that happens at that moment and in the scenes that follow where they address that. Mm-hmm. It's a little clunky. I'm not going to say it's not. Where the chemist says, yes, the sedative's not going to enable you to wake up in this way in the inner ear and la-di-da and bloody-blue. But I loved that progression. I loved the thought progression that I was having, that these guys are shooting at them. What are the stakes here? If they shoot them, they're just going to wake up. Now we're just supposed to worry about automatic weapons fire. Oh, wait a minute. No. If you do kill them in this layer of the dream, then you go into limbo, and we don't know what happens there, and they can stay there for decades, and this is the time progression. And I felt like at the moment that I was having this thought, that the filmmaker was addressing it. And I really loved that. And I felt that that was happening throughout the film. That the moment that I was ever having a question, well, why is this happening? Why is that happening? That the filmmaker was addressing that. And then when this is one of those films that where I get to the end and I have to start spooling through the film, and I can't wait to see the film again, because now I have to see, well, wait a minute, what layer were we in? Because one of the things that is absolutely wonderful for me about Christopher Nolan's films, especially the films he writes himself, is that he is – there is always the feeling, as far as I'm concerned, for his good films, that he is treating the audience as a participant or another layer. So like for the Prestige, for instance, when you're dealing with what you're watching in the film isn't just what's going on. You're also part of that. So he's treating you as a mark. Or well, with this film, you know, you're talking about a dream. And so what I have to think of as an audience member is this a dream for me as well? What layer are we in? And how deep does it go? And where is reality? And I loved the fact that I was constantly thinking, is this real or is this a dream? Does it matter to me? How much does it matter to me? And then when we get to the end, in the very final shot, I have to go over the whole film again and think, what was real? How much of this was real? And what rules apply and where? And I absolutely love that about this film.
Oh, I think that's so generous, because another thing I hated was the ending. I thought that was such a cop-out. I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that the whole movie is a dream, and I don't know why he wants to cut at that point while the top wobbles. I mean, I just thought, you know, he's made an obvious statement.
He saw a serious man and went, sure, just cat ending, perfect.
I guess so. You know, that's really what it felt like. I mean, thing is, you talk about Christopher Nolan. So of Nolan's movies, there are three of them that he did not work from a script that his brother had written. One of them is Inception, another one is Insomnia, and another one is Batman Begins. And all three of those, to me, those are his weakest movies. I love Christopher Nolan as a director. I didn't care for this one, but I found it conspicuous that the movies that I think of his that really work are based on Jonathan Nolan's scripts. And I just the script in this, the fact that it does that cowardly cop out at the end, I hated that. By the way, my audience loved it. The top wobbled, nice. And then it blacked out, and they went, oh, and then cheered. And then they cheered afterwards.
Mine just went, oh, like irritably.
Mine went, oh, and quickly turned it. But I hated that, specifically because if we're going to have a movie about this character, if this movie is about Leonardo DiCaprio's dream, which I think it is. I mean, I think this is he's the emotional core of the movie. He has to make a choice at some point. You know what? That's the thing about Batman, about Dark Knight. Dark Knight is all about choices. You know, what choices do the characters and the people in the movie make? And those choices are spread amongst an ensemble, by the way. I mean, this should be about what does Leonardo DiCaprio do? And the fact that it wants to play coy with that, I just thought was a huge... It just so irritated me. You know, he's trying to be ambiguous and provocative, and instead good Lord, I hated that. I mean, I wasn't enjoying the movie anyway by that point, but that was sort of the final straw. I was like, okay, you know what? Screw you, movie. If you're not going to make a decision about what your character has done, then I...
Purgatory. Dude, why are you hating on Insomnia? Insomnia rules. How dare you?
The original does.
Ooh.
Yeah, how about that?
Hey, you know what scene exemplifies what you're talking about is like Michael Caine.
Thought we were talking about Insomnia. Skarsgård shoots a dog in the original Insomnia. Al Pacino finds a dead one in the American remake. So, what's the Michael
really?
Caine?
He shoots it in the original one.
Yeah,
that is weaker.
Damn.
So there's a lot about that's weaker, but what really helps, and I actually watched Insomnia last night for the first time, Ooh. And what really helps is having quite a few years between seeing the original Insomnia and seeing the remake. Because this is, for me, this was the perfect sort of encapsulation of Tom's, what I'm finding to be a more and more excellent rule of not judging an adaptation based on its source material. Because as anytime any image from the original Insomnia crept into my mind, this Insomnia was really found wanting. But I remembered so little of the original Insomnia, which is a film I just flat out loved. I loved it so much the first time I saw it. I immediately ordered the Criterion Edition for a friend of mine and had it sent to him.
Is it me? Is it on the way?
No, this was years ago.
You're not friends.
Oh.
but seeing it this many years later, I could sort of do what Tom often preaches about, is I could just watch it as its own movie. And as its own movie, it works on a number of levels. It works very well on a number of levels, actually.
Even with Al Pacino. Al Pacino doesn't scuttle it for you?
He really does. He really is. You know, I realize that's like that's a 180, but it's so hard to watch him because he's so awful. But he does a couple of things that simultaneously make and break a couple of scenes. And there's a couple of scenes in Insomnia where I sat there going, I can't stand you. Okay, you made the scene work. But everybody else and the filmmaking itself makes the movie work if you can sort of put the other film out of your head. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, but anyway, I just sort of went off on a thing because the first time I saw the film, and I think it really works. Trying to make it stand on its own, it works.
Racist.
I can't deny that part of my problem with Inception was how excellent Dark Knight was. I mean, Dark Knight, I just can't say enough good things about that movie. Mm-hmm. And that's just a tall shadow to Phil. No, I screwed the idiom up. Those are big shoes to stand in. It casts big shoes.
I think Inception allows him much more freedom, and he gets to play and be much more free than he can with Dark Knight. And there's a trade-off there. You know, we talk about rules, and when you're doing an adaptation, you really have to be a little more strict than that forces you to do certain things, and that can help you. But a certain amount of freedom can help you as well. And the freedom that he was able to explore in Inception really worked for me. And I think that last moment that you were talking about a moment ago, Tom, rather than being a cop-out for me, just forced me to go back and look at the film again, frame by frame in my head, and think, where is the evidence to support what's going on in that last shot? When we get to the end, my tendency when I see this kind of movie is to want – I don't want it to be a dream. I want this – there to be a reality that is sort of a bracketing structure, and then if we want to delve into dreams within that, that's fine. I don't like to get to the end of the movie and be told it's all a dream because I feel like I've wasted my time.
Do you not feel that's what happened here?
Well, I do, but I'm naturally resistant to that. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't give me an out there. He forces me instead to think through, where's the evidence in this film that it is a dream? And then I had to look at those individual things that bugged me or that stuck out for me, and then I thought, oh, yeah, this is evidence, this is evidence, that is evidence, and that's why this works for me, or why I accept it, because I, again, going back to what I said earlier, I think more than a film about heists, it's a film about redemption and about forgiveness and about resolving guilt, much more than it is about heists.
See, Dingus, I want to see that movie. I would have liked to see a movie that was more concerned with Mal, with Marion. Someone help. How do you say her last name?
Marion Cotillard.
Cotillard.
Racist.
By the way, this movie really taps into our fear of Marion Cotillard. I like that. I wanted to see that movie, and I felt like this is the character development we get from Leonardo DiCaprio, is that, yes, he's done Inception before, and he feels that he killed his wife doing it. That right there, I felt, got far too little attention. It was a little sequence. You find out why he feels bad. I guess it's supposed to be the emotional payoff. But the movie built around that emotional payoff, I just thought was so clumsy and disproportionate to that one bit, which I liked. And I liked that concept. And I liked that playing with the idea of an Inception. And all of this stuff about inner ears and it's raining because the guy has to go to the bathroom. And all of that stuff was just like such a weak, sloppy, I felt, support structure for that cool kernel of an idea. I did like that part. And I love Marion Cotillard. I need to see that La Vie en Rose movie that she's in. But I just, good Lord, if it had been about what you're saying, Dingus, more, I think I would have liked it more. Just because I just so was not into the heist surrounding that. Dingus, let me ask you, how do you feel about this, Dingus? When I say that there's no character development beyond Leonardo DiCaprio's character, beyond Cobb, I feel that a good heist movie tends to be an ensemble movie. It tends to require a couple of different interesting characters. And I felt like everybody in this movie got short shrift. I don't understand, you know, they didn't do much with Ellen Page's character. I didn't understand the rivalry between Arthur and Eam. I'm not clear on why why Saito had to go along. It seemed like the movie didn't care about those things, so I didn't really either. Would you address that, Dingus? Was that a problem for you, or do you disagree there?
I absolutely disagree there. Apart from the fact, and well, let me just ask you this real quick before we go to this. How do you feel about the casting of the things you just said?
I love those actors, and I felt it was criminal that they didn't do more with them.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think the film is perfectly cast. So I just wanted to clear the air on that.
But I would say it's perfectly cast because I like the actors, not the characters.
He's not saying it's imperfectly cast.
Yeah.
He's saying it's imperfectly written and executed.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see where we're starting as a baseline. I think the film is perfectly cast, and I think that I disagree with your point on that. I think that the different developments of these characters is appropriate both for the type of heist film you're talking about that has those supporting guys, and I found them delightful. I found just thinking about just to take Thomas Hardy, for instance. The
moment you just
goes
by Tom.
Oh, Tom Hardy, sorry.
Thomas Hardy, I think someone else.
Who's Thomas Hardy? He's not a writer, is he?
Yes, he is.
just to take Tom Hardy's character, Eames. Is that his name, Eames?
Eames, yes.
I it was so delightful for me to go through the progression of and it took me a while, because I'm a little slow, to understand, you know, okay, so in his real world, he's a forger. And in the dream world, he's an impersonator. And that's obvious. That's an obvious connection. It took me a good part of the movie, maybe the third or second time he shows up as Tom Berenger, for me to go, oh, well, that's why he shows up as these people, because he's a forger. In the real world, he's a forger. His analog in the dream world is that he does impersonations, or that he watches them and he finds out about them. Mm-hmm. And so there's this wonderful moment where they first meet, and they go when Tom Cobb goes up with Eames to cash in chips, and Cobb says something about him being a lousy speller. You still need to work on your spelling. You're still a lousy speller, but your artwork's really good. There's something about his forgery that doesn't quite work on the poker chips that he's turning in to get money. And then you fast forward to the moment where he's that blonde woman, and she just doesn't quite look right. She's beautiful, but she's a little weird. She's a little odd. She's a little off. Tallulah, her name's Tallulah, the actress, but she's just the blonde. And contrasting her with the girl in the red dress from The Matrix for me, who's perfect and in a moment. And this blonde is just there, but not quite there. And I love that about him, and I love his relationship with Arthur. But far from being sort of antagonistic, I found it to almost be flirtatious. And that moment when he shows up and says, "You've got to dream bigger, Arthur," and he has that, you know, grenade launcher, I found a delightful moment, purely in the vein, because we're in this part of the dream, from a heist movie. You've got this guy, you've got that guy, you've got the safe cracker, you've got the weapons expert, you've got the lookout man, you've got the driver. And those people, you're not going to get a great deal of character development in that type, in that layer of the dream. But going along with them, I found them great. And Ellen Page, I thought, was fantastic. So, I did not see the movie the way you saw it.
Mm-hmm. Kelly Wand, where do you fall on this?
The acting's good. I liked it more, you know, I don't know. It's fine. Did I ever tell you about that movie Brain Dead with Bill Pullman and Bill Paxton?
I don't think so.
By Charles Beaumont. It's like a 1990 movie. It's like a brain surgeon. He's not sure if he's dreaming or not for the whole movie.
Ah,
it's like
okay.
Up buildings and stuff. I don't know.
Well, why aren't you thinking of Dreamscape with Dennis Quaid in The President's Dream? Do you know that one?
I love that movie.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great movie. Dingus, there's a movie from 1984. I'll bet you don't. I think 84. I meant to look it up. I think I did, and I'm remembering it's 84, where the president is having nightmares about nuclear annihilation. And
Green Acres guy.
That's right, Eddie Albert. And Dennis Quaid plays a dream seeker, intruder, inception type dude. And he goes into the president's nightmare to find out what's going on and uncovers like a plot and becomes like an action movie. But it's this whole idea of going into people's dreams. And
from also an evil one.
Well, it's the guy from the Warriors, isn't it? Isn't it the come out and play Warriors guy? Uh-huh. Is the bad guy who's the evil, he's the evil counterpart to...
He kills an old woman and eats the sandwich. And that's how you know he's evil afterwards. He's having a big lunch.
Wow, you remember way more than me.
It was on Cinemax.
But yeah, I mean, this movie Inception also reminded me a lot of, you know, Dingus, you talk about the redemption theme. I think of how pared down as far as like the rules, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was in favor of the emotional resonance. And Inception reminded me a lot of Eternal Sunshine.
And that was more character-based, and it was resolved based on how the characters, what their psyches were all about. Well, isn't this, it's like, this guy's innermost thought is about the will and the safe, and there's snow. Like, I didn't know, it really bugged me that I know what the snow represented in his subconscious. Does that mean he's not that imaginative, or
well,
that was that his childhood fantasy or something?
Maybe Dingus could speak to this, because this is another complaint that I had, is, you know, a heist movie needs a coherent heist where the audience understands the stakes and the rules, and you know where, you know, it needs a sense of place and action that I thought this movie was completely missing. That snow fort thing was absurd. I mean, I was laughing. It was so loud you wouldn't be able to hear. But that bombastic like James Bond action sequence with just quick cuts of dudes in white, you know, that they were like planting charges and shooting guns and punching each other. That stuff was ridiculous. I mean, that just felt literally laughable to me. That all of that stuff in that snow fortress. And
that's dreams fighting. That's psyches fighting with projections. Like, that's what it would be like. Like, that's how it's resolved in a $160 million budget movie, is fist fights and machine guns.
And as far as the heist goes, I mean, it just felt so just sprawling and messy. You know, all this stuff about time layers and gravity and the energy monopolies and tokens and sedatives. All of that just...
They're all MacGuffins.
It's full of MacGuffins.
This is not a heist film.
Dingus, well,
it's not a heist film. I'm sorry to have to break it to you. This is not a heist film. I understand that you got trapped within those layers of the dream, those heist layers or those levels. They're almost like game design levels, but this is not a heist film.
Well, what would you call it? I'm just talking about it as far as like a genre, as far as what my complaints are and what genres I draw from in terms of what I think it really takes to make this kind of movie work. What would you call it?
I love that bad characterization.
You know, I don't know what genre to label this, and I think it's going to sort of defy that.
You don't think it's a heist film, though, Dingus. You don't think that it's about one guy doing it. I mean, it's classic heist framework. One guy has to do a final job to get out of the business.
It's a what the fuck is going on movie.
I think it's fooling you into that. I think it's more of a film noir that is fooling you as well as the main character into thinking this is a heist. Whereas what the film is actually doing for you and for the character is repairing him. And I think that what we might think about, or what I think about, is that outside of the layers of this is the way they look at him as he's leaving the airport leads me to think that this is all a team designed to go in and help him or build an inception or place an inception in him so that he can go home. That's what this film is about, him going home.
Would you?
And I think they're the team that is designed to help him go home.
Okay.
And that is the external structure that we're missing and that we as an audience are part of it.
Okay, I like that, Dingus. But would you agree, though, and just to sort of explain why I'm talking about it as a heist film, that it does things that a heist film needs to do?
Oh, definitely. And, okay. And I think you're absolutely
that's,
right.
That's
I
mean, all that I'm saying.
The last job I have to do, I have to assemble my team, I have to go to another country to do it. There's a lot of those tropes that are there, but I think there's also a lot about film noir that is there as well, as far as having the femme fatale, having the younger sort of ingenue that comes along and turns out to be his salvation. I think that, that there's that as well.
I don't know what film noirs you're thinking of, but I can't go. If you can't let me call it a high school, I can't let you call it a film noir. But I like what you're saying, Dingus. I really wished I like that eye towards it. But I felt that even though that that's ultimately what it's trying to do, it was doing it in the context of a heist film. And I agree there's definitely another layer there. But what I do want to talk about then is that I found some of that heist stuff, like the Snow Fortress, like laughable. That didn't bother you? Like, you were okay with that stuff? How did you feel, Dingus, about that level of the movie?
I felt like I was watching an easy level on a video game. Because I'm not very good at them, but I can use a sniper rifle and plink off the guys on the outer level. And that's what I felt like I was watching. But what I had to keep remembering, and what I love about that level, is that we're in the third level of... at least the third level at this point. And what I love is the editing that is letting me layer the time differences in, so that when we get to this ice fortress, I'm not really so much worried about who's shooting who in the ice fortress as I'm thinking about what is going on right now in the hotel room and what is going on right now in the van. How is the time difference going with the van group? How is the time difference going in the hotel? And what is the time here? And I loved sort of stacking up all of those layers of time and then having to wonder, outside of this, where is he really? And I love the way all of that is edited. And as far as what you're concerned with, Tom, as far as laughing at the snow fortress, that never occurred to me, because every now and then we cut back to that van's falling, and that just was jaw-dropping for me. I just loved the timing and the editing of that entire sequence, so that when it comes right down to it, running around in the snow doesn't really bother me.
I didn't like the van falling either. I mean, that also became laughable to me. It was the slow motion.
And they used underwater snorkels in the street.
They had in their dream pockets. I mean,
Dingus, I have a question. But go on, Tom.
No, you take it. You take it, Kelly Wand. You're the voice of reason here, Kelly Wand. Dingus and I are the far extremes.
Okay. Does it bother Dingus at all that Fisher's dad only said that little cool, cute speech at the end about the disappointment thing because he was just saying a rehearse? When was he a projection? Was he a projection of Fisher's? Was he Eames pretending to be the dad? Because it wasn't the actual dad. So did that cute line he says about, I was disappointed that you wanted to be like me, like, is just a fabrication of that they wrote for the DiCaprio team?
It doesn't bother me, because by then that's all a part of what has to happen to Fisher. A lot of this comes to me after. While I'm watching it, if I can put myself in that moment, because I didn't quite understand the whole overall framework, and I still don't think I understand the overall framework, but in the moment of watching that, I realize that's all a part of what they said was going to happen, which is that by the time he gets to that level, his father has to say to him something so that it seems like it's a fresh idea. And what I liked about that is that it's a very simple sort of boneheaded thing for me, is that, you know, he says to Browning, Tom Berenger, I think his character name is Browning, when they're in the torture scene, he was disappointed. He was disappointed in me. And then we get down there, and this is his subconscious giving a reason for his father saying disappointed because of the other things that have happened in the interim. As they said would happen. He has to do this, he has to do this, and he has to come to the idea on his own in this way, so that when he gets the thing out of the safe, then his father says this thing to him that is, of course, his creation. So none of that.
No, they think that's not his creation.
I don't think that's right.
It's the opposite of what you're saying.
Yeah,
they made him think it was. They incepted.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But from his point of view, it's his creation.
But it's not. But his point of view is faulty. Like, we know it's not true.
That's okay. It doesn't matter what we know. It
matters
to him.
They're being John Edward. They're John Edwarding him. They're giving
him explain that.
They're making him think it's his dead father actually talking to him, but it's not. They're right. Scripting it so they can pull off some corporate shenanigans that we
Did that bother you, Kelly Wand? Because I from a moral perspective, or
no, just because it seemed like that you're supposed to go, oh, that's so sweet, but it's a total bullshit thing. So
exactly,
it's a
trick that they've played on them. And I'm pretty sure, too, isn't the concept that Ellen Page has built these levels? She built the snow fortress. She built the highway with the city for the van to have the chase on. She built the hotel. She built the hospital room. Isn't that the case?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she builds all this stuff. And
they wrote the will that they put in the safe that she built.
Right. Right. So all of this is stuff that his subconscious provides, things like trained warriors and whatnot, but all of these levels, and this is one reason too that I thought it was kind of goofy. I mean, tell me more about what Ellen Page is doing and why she's doing it. You mm-hmm. have this great detail about her doing the circular maze. What's the deal with this ridiculous snowfall?
Yeah, right away, a freight train drives through her best efforts.
Which is another thing, too, where I thought, really sloppy with the rules. If that can happen, if she can create something, and his subconscious doesn't just have Marianne Cotillard running around looking menacing, but has a freight train running through
it. The first level.
Exactly, the first level.
Within seconds.
And I hated the fact that was sort of glossed over and didn't really come up.
And then he goes, well, we're screwed. We can't do it. So it's like, this is the best guy ever. And he's like, oh, yeah, sorry about the freight train.
And that was another thing, too, is it set up for me expectations that we were going to see a lot of more cool stuff like that, which we didn't.
No.
So I mean,
on snowmobiles that they dispatch easily.
Skiing behind a Humvee.
Yeah. With such weird wheels. That's what the billionaire dreams about.
See, that's not what he dreams about. That's what she writes for him. And I wanted to know why.
Jonathan Nolan.
Right, exactly. I mean, that was the only answer I could come up with, because Christopher Nolan thought it would look cool. And Dingus, that's cool that it didn't bother you, and you have a higher level of sort of a higher look at what's going on that you enjoyed more. But that higher level that you're talking about just didn't grab me enough, I guess. So I was busy laughing at the guys being towed behind the Humvee with the snow cat tires and Joseph Gordon-Levitt doing, basically they wasted him, I thought. I mean, he was all wire work, basically.
No characterization at all. Zero.
So, Dingus, are you with us there? I liked what you said about Tom Hardy. You love Joseph Gordon-Levitt like we do. Were you okay with what they did with him there? Did you enjoy him?
Yeah, I'm very happy with him. I've never seen him have a fight like that, and that is going to go down. And I'm really sort of talking from a point of being a little bit shocked at how little you guys
liked
this movie, because
I was
jaw dropped for most of the movie. I don't even think you can use it like that. I was dropped jawed, slack jawed. I was a slack jawed yokel. That fight. Is such a great fight. It's going to go down as an iconic fight. It's fantastic.
Oh, Dingus. Yeah,
iconic fights, time out. Both participants really well. Vader, Luke, icon. This guy, security guard number 843, is what face we never see.
I got to call you out on that one too, Dingus. I mean, that's cool that you dug it, and I actually liked it too. But oh, good lord, I cannot agree with you there.
I like the workload. I'm a sucker for things that look like there are a lot of hassle to make.
Yeah,
I know this movie just looked like a nightmare to shoot and write and think about, and I appreciated that. I thought it was a cool, wacky, free ride movie.
I think if there's anything close to Joseph Gordon-Levitt having an iconic moment, and it's another thing that I thought was kind of sloppy but cool, it's him making the little infinite loop stairs and then looping around and pushing the bad guy off the edge. I love that wall turning fight was cool, but I thought that was far more. I think it meets your criteria, Dingus, for something to be remembered more, that infinite loop staircase.
It had more to do with the movie, too. Like, he used dream logic to...
Right, win. Right.
See, Ellen Page should have done that. That would have been a good Ellen Page.
Well, I loved watching him in that fight, especially given what's going on in the van at the time. You know, I loved the way they were dealing with gravity and what he has to accomplish in those moments, and again the timing that he has to do it in, and how that's layered in with what's going on in the van. I loved that.
Mm-hmm. But it all just worked out like arbitrarily. Like, okay, the
van's
taking 20 years to go down, so we have lots of time. But it feels like we don't have any time. They have decades, I thought.
on level four, but they suddenly it's the band's taking forever to go into the water.
That's a representation of the different layers of time. And in their time, they have this amount of time. And the next layer up, you have that amount of time. And then the next layer up, you have this amount of time. So we could show the band going 10 seconds. That's not very interesting visually. But we're watching it all as stacked up layers of time. And I love that. And I don't know if it works out mathematically. And I worry there are things that nag at me, like where'd that 10 years go to, they kept alluding to. But but I love the way that's edited and the way that's stacked up. And it was breathtaking for me.
The kids were the same age, so I guess it was a dream.
That to me was the clincher. I mean, right there, the fact that
There's that wonderful early moment in his apartment when he gets the phone call, and he's talking to the kids, and there's this weird thing that's happening when he's talking to Philippa and James, and Philippa sounds so much older than she should sound, and then he talks to James, and he's that little kid, and I couldn't really understand what was going on with time here, because can I talk to you? I think he's asking to talk to grandmother, and then Philip, is that you, Philippa? But Philippa sounds like a teenager in the phone call. It's very odd, and then it cuts off at an odd moment, and then Joseph Gordon-Levitt comes in and says, "Our ride's on the roof." And there are those little moments like that where I had to constantly kind of look back and go, that doesn't make any sense unless this is a dream. You know,
Grandma was in the movie, was she, except for that call scene?
Don't think so. No.
Right. And there's a couple other moments that really made me look back, because again, I'm resistant to a movie that's
going
to be a dream. But there's a couple other moments I had to look back and go, yeah, that's too weird not to be, or that's classic sort of dream thinking.
Unreliable narrator.
Like when he's like in that foot race when he's in Mombasa and he runs between the buildings and he gets stuck.
Right.
That's a wonderful dream type moment, or the really odd and to me very frightening scene in the hotel room when he's talking to Mal, who, you know, obvious movie names. Hello, Mal. He's talking to her, and she's on the ledge of the room he's in, but she's across the way. And he's gesturing to come in so we can talk, as if she is on the same ledge and she could step toward him. Come in so we can talk. And she's in the same room or on the ledge of the same room he's in, but he's looking across a chasm at her. That's a really weird sort of illogical dream moment that really sort of that stands out for you. It's probably obvious to everybody else, but for me it was just, that's weird. Why is he gesturing that way? And so there's those little moments that I love, those little sort of clues that get planted here and there that I have to go back and look back at to convince myself what he's talking about.
Here's a couple moments I loved that don't necessarily address what you're talking about, Dingus, but just things that I was like, that's cool. I wish that was in a movie I liked better. When he tries to hide in the restaurant, and normally that's where the character would get away. You know, he's at Mombasa or whatever. He's running, and he ducks into the restaurant, and the guys are chasing him. And he sits down, and he's just going to sit. You know, in a normal movie, he would sit next to him, and the waiter would come by and get him a drink or whatever, and would walk off, and he would have eluded his pursuers. But the waiter is like, what? What do you want? I mean, he's talking another language. They can't speak the same language. The waiter kicks up a ruckus. The guys sitting next to him don't want him there. It's like, I love that in normal movies, that works. In this movie, that didn't work for him to escape because the guys heard the waiter yelling. I loved that. Another little touch I loved, in his initial little heist test dream with Saito, he pulls out a pistol with a silencer, and there's a couple of stealth, it's like the stealth level, and there's a couple of points where he shoots a dude, and he's holding his hand over the gun, and I was like, what are you doing? And I realized he's catching the shell being ejected from the gun before it lands and clatters on the patio. I loved that little moment. So those are two touches I liked in what I felt was otherwise a very poorly done action movie.
Something that did bother me as I watched it, and I'm glad you brought up Eternal Sunshine, because what I kept thinking about was Schenectady, New York. I'm ashamed to say that film really didn't work for me, and I just I don't think I put the mental time into it.
Ooh.
You do have to work that movie. That movie does take work, Dingus, and I'm with you. I have not put the mental time in it, so I really feel like
maybe the last 10 years, masterpiece, fools.
All right, but go ahead. So what about Schenectady?
And you know, now that Kelly reacts that way, there might be an element of that this film is more sort of a little bit more the lazy man's version of that, because that didn't work for me. And what I kept thinking in watching Inception, especially when they're in the first dream lesson at the cafe in France, and he tells her this is your first dream lesson, and the reaction, and this is her reaction and the reaction in dream worlds in general within this movie, is when the dream starts to fall apart, things just start exploding and falling apart, rather than things becoming surreal and absurd. So I sort of thought as I was leaving, why do we have things exploding and explosions upon explosions instead of somebody with three heads, or why does the Hummer not grow a giraffe's head, or why aren't things becoming weird and surreal in this dream rather than just exploding and crumbling?
Right.
And what I sort of had to face was, well, that's because this film was directed by Chris Nolan and not by Charlie Kaufman. And Charlie Kaufman's Inception would be, you know, not only does Paris fold over upon itself when Ellen Page decides to test the physics, but, you know, people start sprouting new limbs and all manner of things happen that are beyond my imagination. And instead, this was the action version of that happening rather than the cerebral version of that happening.
The synecdoche comparison I want to bring up, and Kelly, let me know if you agree with this. Synecdoche seems to do what Inception does, but backwards, in that synecdoche doesn't tell you that it's explaining the rules. You don't know that until after you've seen basically the events. And then going back, you can see the rules. I think it takes a second viewing to understand the rules and really see what's going on. Whereas Inception is basically like a professor or a game manual telling you A, then B, then C, and here's what happens here, and here's what happens here. So Synecdoche doesn't do any of that. It makes you sit through basically the heist, and then if you rewatch it, you can figure out the rules. Kelly Wand, is that a fair
opposite? Yeah, and it does the opposite time-wise, like at Ellen Gates,
right,
Inception compresses.
But Ding, to address what you were saying, I think that the reason Christopher Nolan does these rules, and good Lord, I wished there had been more of this, is I loved the final bit where he's in the city that he constructed with Mal, and the sea is encroaching on it, and it's falling apart. That one shot there, I mean, I didn't care for the movie at all, but if I had to pick a moment where I was most tolerant of the movie, it would have been that one shot and that one image of they've created this fantastic metropolitan area with all of their memories in it, and it's crumbling away at the edges, and the sea is just coming in, you know, the sea representing chaos and I guess unformed dream stuff, unstructured dream stuff, I think is what they said limbo would be. It's sort of limbo coming back.
Racist.
What?
I don't know.
Let me ask you guys a quick question. Early on in the movie, Cobb has a scene with Mal, and she asks him this question. How does she say it? She says, "Tell me, do the children miss me?" Mm-hmm. And his answer, do you remember what his answer to her was?
What?
His answer to her is, "I can't imagine."
That was Tom's guess.
"I can't imagine" is his answer. "Tell me, do the children miss me? I can't imagine." And then later in the film, when he's in sort of the resolution scene with her, he comes forth with this, "I can't imagine you any better than this. And this is why I'm letting you go, because I lack the power to bring you to life anymore." But that early moment, when I think back through the movie, because that whole "don't look at the kids' faces" thing really nags at me, until we get to the end. And then she asks him, "Tell me, do the children remember me, or do the children miss me?" And he says, "I can't imagine." Did that strike you guys? Do you have anything to say about that? Or is this, I guess the film's so meaningless for you two that I guess that these types of things don't really matter.
Well, no. I mean, I think it's one of the clues you're talking about. I mean, I really do think, you know, I know he probably thinks he was being ambiguous, but I really do think that there's internal support for within the internal logic of the movie for the fact that it's all a dream. And stuff like that, Dingus, I think just goes to that point.
Which makes me like the movie less. I don't want to be watching someone's dream. I just came off the Lost finale. I'm still annoyed. And in Shutter Island, it wasn't even a dream. Like, it all sort of happening.
The one that gets me is Memento. At the end of Memento, this character has made a choice. And that choice is the reveal, and it's sort of the emotional culmination of Memento, is when he decides to erase his past. I mean, that's a huge payoff, I think. And to just have this all be a dream, I just want to keep saying cop out. I mean, that just made me so angry that he still wants to tease with the idea of the top wobbling.
It's
and then,
predictable.
It's so predictable, exactly, Kelly Wine. I think it's pretty cheap, too. And I think it really undercuts what could have been some really cool stuff here with what Dingus is talking about as far as it being a movie about redemption. And Dingus, this idea that really this movie is a team going in to repair him, I love that. And I think I don't think that's what Nolan is trying to do. I think that's a cool interpretation. But I wish that Christopher Nolan had that interpretation with his script rather than this coy pretending to be ambiguous when he's really not.
Yeah. Dingus.
I still think that there's evidence for that interpretation there. I think that's what it is. That's what the movie's trying to do. It's just not making it obvious.
Mm. Does it make it lamer, though?
Well, you know, if it makes it too obvious, then it's lame. If it doesn't make it obvious, then it's lame. So how is it supposed to win, exactly?
Make it better.
Just leave that part of it out.
Actually, I do really feel that that was really... I mean, so Dingus, the fact that he cuts while the top is wobbling, you were okay with that ambiguity.
God, my Annie hated that. It's funny that yours liked it, because mine was... Ah, you can just feel the...
They started to do that, but then they cheered. Yep.
Mine didn't cheer. Right. It was just, in silence.
Dingus, what about you and your audience? How did they feel about that?
They were silent.
My audience felt like they were in on the joke, but they started that way. There was this wonderful thing that happened with my audience, if you'll indulge me for this quick moment. The film started excellently as a group. As a group dynamic, because I went to see it at a theater called the Arclight, which usually only shows three previews. That's their rule. They show three trailers, and then you're into the movie. No commercials, three trailers, bam. But there were four trailers before this film. The first three trailers were three trailers that you would think were likely. I don't remember what they were because I wasn't watching them. The fourth trailer was for this goofy movie called Charlie St. Cloud. Do you know what this movie is? It's a Zac Efron thing,
yeah.
It's a Zac Efron. I don't know if it's Nicholas Sparks, but it looks like a Nicholas Sparks novel. And the movie is about this guy who – all this is given away in the preview. This guy who's going to teach his little brother to play baseball, but his little brother gets killed by a drunk driver. He runs into the ghost of his little brother in the forest, and he spends every day, because he promised, every day I'm going to teach my brother to play baseball.
His brother's ghost. He teaches his brother's ghost in the graveyard, I think. Yeah.
Right, and it's really touching.
Those field of dreams.
With Zac Efron.
Exactly. Yeah. But then Zac Efron meets a girl who's going to sail around the world, but he can't go with her, because if he leaves his brother, then he's breaking his promise to his brother.
But she goes
to sail, and her boat gets lost, so he has to choose. Am I going to sail to rescue this girl, or am I going to be with my brother every day? The ghost of my brother.
That's ripped from today's headlines.
Yeah.
And so the last shot of this preview is him standing on a boat with his brother, and he says to his brother, it's this touching moment, he says...
He can ride the boat. That's good.
He says, we'll always be brothers. And my theater just erupted into laughter. They just laughed their heads off at this preview. It's supposed to be this treacly, just, oh my gosh.
They give away that much in the preview, like the end of the movie, it sounds like it.
It was great. It was the whole theater was just laughing at this preview. And my wife, who would probably like this movie, said, I guess this isn't the demographic for that movie. And that's how the movie started. So the audience was in solidarity for the entire movie. They clapped after the fight scene that I was talking about. And at the end, there was that feeling of, what? Oh! And so at the very end, there was a feeling that they were in on the joke. And for my part, I don't like to be, you know, I don't like to be sort of jerked around, but I do like a little bit of ambiguity from time to time. And what I said earlier is this just forced me to look back and make my own decision about is this a dream or is it not? Because the evidence, what I wanted to think about sleeping was it looks like that thing's about to tip over. If it was, then he would have showed us that.
Right.
So I'm not real crazy about that last shot, but I can live with it.
All right.
Well, maybe it's about him not seeing it fall over because he doesn't care anymore whether it's real. And that's
the thing. I think the mission was to get him to come home, which is something he was not able to do. And so he is able to come home. He doesn't look away when his kids look at him. He can see their faces again. And whether he's going to live in limbo or not, he's home again. And that's what
this is. Purgatory?
Well, I think they call it limbo here, but I don't know what that is. That must be from a TV show you once watched.
By the way, at the end of Limbo, when I saw it, the audience booed.
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, feet apart and out of free, getting down with 3 feet, everybody loves
open. That was spirited.
When was the end of Limbo? Spoiler alert.
The John Sayles movie. Have you not seen Limbo, Kelly Wand? I think it's one of John Sayles' finest movies. I would have a hard time picking between that and Lone Star and Mate One. You know what? I don't know. Yeah, Limbo's my favorite John Sayles
movie.
What's
the one about the miners who get upset?
That's Mate One.
That's Brother from Another Planet, actually.
Spoiler.
I love that characterization of it. They get upset.
Racist. Yeah.
Why don't we have a lunch break?
They shake their fists.
Matewan, by the way, is not about miners that get upset. Matewan is almost a Western, actually. Matewan holds up.
Matewan rules, if I remember
Matewan
right.
Matewan is heist. It's a heist movie, as I understand it.
It's about Japan, but it's about Kentucky or something.
Let's do a 3x3. So let's see. Kelly Wand, you had a good 3x3. I quite like this. Why don't you tell the audience? Yeah, I did.
This is tough. This is really tough. I had so many. This is great.
Yeah, I got one dingus will like, and the others no one will like. But some of them are more for us, because I think will be funny, but some of them are for the listeners, because they'll come up with really good ones. Mm-hmm. And go, oh, yeah, see? I don't know what they get out of that. Oh, remind me, I have a good contest reward, but we have to think of a contest for it.
Okay.
Do that later. I meant to do that before the podcast, but here we are.
All right.
Back to the 3x3. Three best last lines by a dying character or words spoken to a dying character as they die, which I needed to qualify it so I could put one on this.
Okay.
I think it would be better without that particular suffix qualifier, but I needed it.
So when I start mine, we'll get to this. I had a problem with how this might be done, but I'll be curious what you guys did. So, Dingus, you're introducing next week's 3x3, so you go first. What is your number 3 best last line spoken by or to a dying character?
All right. First of all, these are all by a dying character. I did not go with the suffix weak wimp out. I mean, the qualifier. These are all by the dying character. And it's important that we know, well, actually not for my list, it is a character, not a person, but anyway, spoken by, okay. by a dying character. Since we are talking lines, I don't think I even have to apologize for giving, a quote. Here.
Right. Is it the quote or is it a different quote from the movie?
No, this
is it from a different movie.
This is a quote from a different movie by the same character who is also dying. This is the dying line. This is the titular dying line.
All right.
Are you folks ready? I'll take that as a yes.
Folks ready?
All right, here we go. That's not the line, Cooper.
Oh, I wrote that down. I think it's... You had your I'm doing a line intonation.
Right. Here's the line. Now, what are you prepared to do?
Shrek?
Yes, it's Shrek. Good job.
Paired to
who dies in Shrek?
Good point. It was his. He was doing his Mike Myers Scottish accent.
That's right.
Now what?
Braveheart.
Oh, good lord! Is it really? No, that's Freedom. Isn't his last line in that Freedom?
It's not
yeah.
great.
Besides, nobody's...
It's, if you dress like a pig in heat, something.
Thing is, I don't think we know this.
I didn't do really more. Do the line properly because it would involve me sounding like I was... My mouth
was it said by
blood.
James Doohan?
It was not said by James Doohan.
That's a good one. Star Trek.
Sure, James Doohan. Yeah. Racist.
So your mouth is full of blood, Dingus. Sure. What else would we need to get the picture? Who? What actor are you playing this character?
What?
Robin? There are a lot of people got shot in the throat.
Well, you guys are you're guessing a lot of crappy Scottish people. So try to...
Do the whole thing all over again. The listeners just want to just keep hearing it over. That any answers or solutions. Just like Inception.
Now, what are you prepared? I don't think I know this.
Are you folks... Okay, is it a Mad Max movie? Spoiler alert. Is it Apocalypto? Is it any Mel Gibson?
It is not a Mel Gibson movie.
That was not an Australian accent, Kelly Wand.
Oh.
I think it's... Give us another hint.
This is a guy who's known for doing a Scottish accent from time to time, even though he's not playing a Scot.
So I married an ex-murderer.
This one he's actually playing an Irish dude. Even when he's playing a Russian guy, he does a Scottish accent. He's pretty great about that.
The Commitments.
Gerard Butler, I guess, but no.
Part of
300.
No. 300 will never be on this list.
I like 300. How dare you?
You're an idiot.
Well, yes, but still.
Let's get back to Dingus's idiocy for a moment.
So he plays a Russian, and he's always got an Irish accent. It's got to be Colin...
Scottish!
Alexander.
Burgess Meredith in Rocky II.
All right, I'm going to make it easy for you to get to the actor. Ready?
Go.
What's it going to be, Trebek?
Oh, it's Connery.
It's Will Ferrell. In what movie does Will Ferrell die and say, now what are you prepared to do?
Will Ferrell plays this awesome character in The Untouchables, and you can't even tell it's him.
Oh. That's good.
He's lying.
I like your choice. No,
Will Ferrell is in The Untouchables?
Yeah.
No, he's... I like your choice, Dingus.
Dingus, I don't have a pencil. I only have a pen, so what I write down, I can't erase. So.
Oh, you know what? I thought, are you folks ready? Was the line before that. That was what was screwing me up.
Sure. Sorry, I apologize. Now, this is, of course, Sean Connery in The Untouchables, a film
directed
by Brian De Palma and written by somebody, a Frenchman named David Mamet. And this is something that came to me a little bit late in the week, but I love this performance, and I really love this movie. I haven't seen this movie in a very, very long time. Yeah, and this is just a really great, weird death scene, but a very powerful death scene because of what's going on in the overall structure of the movie. And this line is a callback to an earlier line when Elliot Ness has asked I can't remember his name now. I think it's Malone.
Charles Nelson Smith.
Has asked Malone to join his Untouchables squad, and Connery has said to him, what are you prepared to do? And he said, you know, everything within the law, basically. And his response is, then what are you prepared to do? And so we get to that moment where he's been murdered by Capone's men. Costner, thank you. Costner finds him, and they have this great death scene. And the things Costner is saying are entirely mundane, but what Connery's trying to do in getting him to the final stage of the story, and then telling him what are you prepared to do, is just this wonderful character moment.
Good. All right.
Do you like that movie, Tom?
I have not seen it in a long
time. Version.
You know, I haven't seen it probably since it was in theaters, and I'm kind of over. I don't know about over, but I'm kind of soured on Brian De Palma. I need to go back and appreciate some of his earlier stuff.
You know what sucks for me? Scarface.
I've never seen Scarface. I keep forgetting it's Brian De Palma too.
It's really dumb. Like,
oh, is it? But
yeah, it sucks.
Okay, but it's...
No, Carrie's good. I like The Fury, and I like Blowout a lot with Travolta.
Right?
Where he puts the sound guy?
Yeah, no, Blowout is from Blow Up. I mean, it's
just... But Death Fatale is a dream movie, so that sucks, if you ask me.
What about Mission to Mars? Where do you stand on that?
It's got that one good part with Tim Robbins.
What about Mission Impossible?
Ah, that's right. That's right.
I kind of like it. I like the first one. I'm an idiot.
Because would you recommend, would you say Untouchables is vintage De Palma? Like, you think it holds up?
Yeah. I like them. I'm with Dennis.
I haven't seen it in a long time. I don't know. I in my memory, it holds up, and I don't know if it counts as vintage De Palma in the way we think of sort of body double.
It's got an iconic action sequence in it.
That's true.
And it has Robert De Niro beating someone with a bat. That's kind of good.
That's iconic. That's
iconic.
Yeah, no joke. That is iconic. That scene there, yeah.
Them dead. I want their families dead. I want their houses burned to the ground.
That's your De Niro impression, Kelly Wand?
Yeah.
At least Dingus went all out. Come on.
That's actually my Costnery.
All right, I'm going to do my number
three. It's a good movie. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, my number three, last line. So the thing is, like, I didn't know... Like, dying character, can he be about to die? Like, not technically dying? Like, can it be a you're terminated effort?
No.
Okay, well, I didn't do any of those. This one might...
She wasn't about to die.
Well, she says it to the Terminator before...
Yeah, the Terminator. Well, that's true. The Terminator dies. Good
work. Or you know, smile, you son of a... And I don't even think he gets bitch in there. Like, you know, can you do that? Like in Jaws. That's not a character.
The shark dies. The shark hears them.
So the shark's
less words the shark hears.
Okay.
What? I told you that for a moment, but the shark isn't dying yet.
Well, but he's about to die.
Yeah, right. But it's not about to die, it's dying.
Quint.
Oh, you know what? It is hurt. So in this, okay, here's the thing. In my number three, we might have to disqualify because the character is not. Well, let me just give you the line. You ready?
Hmm.
He won't even know your name.
Hmm. The Body Snatchers with Nicole Kidman?
No.
I mean, right?
So it's part of an...
Wait. It's something I've seen recently. It's something good, right?
Something excellent, and the character isn't dead yet when it's said to the character. He's about to die. And it's one of those, smile, you son of a... It's like one of those kind of lines. It's like a last ding, not a tagline kind of thing.
It's a suck it.
Yeah, it's exactly right, except better written. Yeah.
Wait a minute. This is a couple years ago.
Yes.
It's new.
Does it have anything to do with the name Ariadne?
Is that her name? I don't remember that being her name.
No, that's the name of a character in the movie we did this week.
Tom doesn't remember it.
But that's not her name in the movie that I'm thinking of, I don't think.
No. I'm just doing a play on words.
Ah, well, how is that a play on words?
Jennifer's body.
Ariadne was known as the mistress of the labyrinth in Greek mythology.
Right. She's the one who spun out the thread for Theseus to escape. Right.
No one ever used a string against a minotaur before.
All right. Well, never mind. It's not the movie I'm thinking of.
Well, here's the exchange. Tell my son what time his father died. No.
Well, then,
he won't
then
even
right.
know your name. And then she shoots him.
Yeah, then I'm right. Okay, good.
Oh. Well, you can say it.
Strikes back.
You can say it, Dingus.
It's Pan's Labyrinth, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
So the colonel or the brutal fascist general who's been, like, torturing people, and he's constantly checking his watch throughout the movie, and, you know, the little girl's trying to protect her stepbrother, who's this guy's son. And then at the end, when this guy thinks he's absconded with the little baby, and that's the whole struggle of the movie, is this little girl trying to protect her stepbrother. He thinks he's absconded with a little baby. You know, he's concerned about his heritage. He's about to escape, but then the loyalists, the royal, whatever, the rebels catch up with him, and he bravely decides, okay, he's going to die, and he's, you know, he hands over the baby and says, tell my son what time his father died. And the leader of the rebels says, no, he won't even know your name, and then they shoot him.
Yeah.
That's a great line, and it translates really well.
Oh, that's right. I should have pointed out it's in Spanish. I don't think I can do it in the Spanish.
Racist.
But that's the thing where he's not dead yet. He's about to be dead. He knows he's about to be dead. So in that regard, he's dying.
That's the last good movie What's-His-Face made. Then he Hellboyed out and went Hollywood.
He alternates going Hollywood, though. Like, he did that after the first Hellboy. He does Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, then Hellboy 2.
There's one good one he made before that, where it's like the Orphanage, but it's not The Orphanage.
So Orphanage didn't make Devil's Backbone, he did, which was kind of Orphanage.
That's what it is. Yeah, yeah. I like that one.
Yeah.
That was good.
Yep. Pan's Labyrinth, by the way, I own it on DVD, and I've watched the DVD, but I got the Blu-ray and have never gotten around to watching the Blu-ray. Holy cats, it looks fantastic. God, yeah. A gorgeous movie. I mean, that's the kind of thing where you're like, yes, Blu-ray, you know, high definition. Man, that looks amazing.
Pan's Labyrinth is one of those movies that makes me think this is why American movies aren't as good as foreign movies, because there's just an unpredictability to foreign releases that you'd never get from Hollywood anymore.
And I don't want to spoil anything, but as far as that thin line between ambiguity and jerking the audience around, compared to the movie that we talked about this week, Pan's Labyrinth, I think, is a classic example, whether you like Inception or not. Pan's Labyrinth is so good about treading that fine line. I mean, I personally feel that I'm very clear about what happened. I've seen it several times, but I still can accept other people's interpretation. Like, I think there's a supportable interpretation that it wasn't all a dream, which is what I feel.
It's dumb of her to eat the food, though, huh?
That's little kids for you. That's what they do in fairy tales.
She's smart all the rest of the time.
She's hungry.
She's also hungry.
Yeah.
That's true. You get hungry in dreams. That's what you learn. Tell me
what is your number three best last line spoken by or to a dying character?
Deservin's got nothing to do with it.
Oh, so nice. Wow. You know what? I'm glad I didn't think of that, because I probably would have picked it. And you would have
great. Speak. Yeah.
Dingus, do you know what that is?
It's not said by the dying character, so I feel I feel Dingus is like, oh, you've tainted it with the words spoken.
But you know what, though, Kelly?
No, this is your category. That's fine. And I don't...
Dingus doesn't know it. But Kelly Wan, the thing is, it's such an important part. It's an exchange with the dying character. And it's such an important reply to the dying character's
house.
Test.
That's his last line.
Is it that I didn't deserve this? I was going to build a house?
Yeah.
Yeah. God, that's fantastic. Dingus,
Westerns are all the best last lines.
Dingus doesn't know it. Make him guess.
He doesn't know that line? I know that's one of the very few lines I think I would get. Like, I'm not good.
Is it Unforgiven? I don't know.
Yeah. Definitely Unforgiven. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
That's great, Kelly Wand.
T-Y.
That's not even on my list. You know, I had so many films that I had to kick off, and that never even came close.
I would like to issue a blanket statement that any movie on this list is a good movie. So far, it's 3 for 3. That's all I'm saying. I'm about to ruin it. Any movie that's capable of having an awesome last line, the whole movie makes the whole movie awesome.
All right, Dingus, what is your number two best last line spoken by or to a dying character?
Wait, is it me again?
Yep. Yeah. I don't waste time.
Here's the line. You're good. You're an absolute good, Kelly Wand. Here's my line. Harry's here. Take my gun. I'm going to die now, I think.
Harry's here. Take my gun. I'm going to die, I think.
I'm going to die now, I think.
In Bruges?
Very good, Tom. Colin Farrell apologist. Racist.
But that's Brendan Gleeson's line, right? Yeah, after he's fallen. God, that's an awesome movie. I've only seen that once, and I consider that a failing. I mean, in that I need to see it more than once. That movie's
all awesome movies.
The thing is that I got to give you credit for trying to sound like Brendan Gleeson. I could see what you were doing there.
Dingus can do any accent. That's one of his talents, isn't it?
Well, the problem is you end up actually. What I kept ending up doing was doing Colin Farrell's. Where's my gun, Ken? Where's my gun? And that's not Brendan Gleeson's accent. And plus, his face is full of asphalt. It's just a great moment. God, it's just a great moment.
Go ahead.
I don't know how to deal with it. You know, I wanted to start each one of these by saying I'm about to ruin this movie. I'm about to ruin
it. I know.
This category is just going to be chock full of spoilers. And I don't know how to deal with that. We talk about this time and again, but you know, I just ruined the film in Bruges for people. And you know, they shouldn't click on this thread, I guess.
But, I'm too high to remember what you just said. So
But that whole moment, the whole lead up to the moment and him talking, and again, this is like The Untouchables. Colin Farrell is not saying anything of weight to him. Colin Farrell's just asking, "Where's my gun?" But everything that's going on for Colin Farrell there. I mean, I love Colin Farrell in this movie. It's one of my favorite performances of his. If not, maybe it's just my it's my favorite performance of his. His face as he's dealing with Brendan Gleeson there on the cobblestones, or whatever he's landed in, and he's just asking Ken, "Where's my gun?" And that's all he says. And Ken's tried has made this moment to warn him about Harry being in town. That's it. And he says, "Get my gun," and Cullen pulls his gun out, and it's broken.
That's right. Oh my God, Dingus, that's right. Wow.
It's destroyed, and that's why Ray, I think, is Cullen's character, says, "Where's my gun?" And it's just this great moment. And it's just the payoff of this wonderful relationship that these two characters have, and that these two actors have built. For me, Brendan Gleeson can do no wrong. I just love that guy.
That's what's great.
He's great Smoking the Bandit, by the way.
Dare you?
We're having a serious discussion over here.
I didn't see this movie because I don't see movies with prepositions in the title. What were you going to say, Tom?
Kelly Wand, you need to see this. And that's what's great about yours too, Kelly Wand, is that line Clint Eastwood says to Gene Hackman is such a payoff for that their character's interaction. And it's the same dingus with Brendan Gleeson and Colin Farrell. Very nice.
Lines that sum up the movie and are the apotheosis of the genre.
Yeah. Okay, now here's where my number two is going to kind of screw up. It's not quite so grandiose, but it's such a great statement for how the movie plays out. So here's the line. "I'd get you something to drink, but I'm afraid you'd just choke on it." Do you know it, Dingus?
I don't, but I love it. Wait. Oh.
Places in the Heart. In Country.
It's Robin Hood.
Okay, so it's actually, I'm kind of cheating because there's a little bit more said afterwards. I just like that little snippet. Here's the full line because I put it on to get it. "I sure hope you're not in frightful pain, Wood. I'd get you something to drink, but I'm afraid you'd just choke on it. Little Ida's going to miss you. So is the rest of the family."
Misery?
So it's the final...
Not No Country, is it?
No. But similar. Same cinematographer.
Go ahead.
It's right after the shootout between Paul Schneider and Jeremy Renner in Assassination of Jesse James, which is just one of my favorite instances of of realistic movie violence. It takes place in the middle of the movie. These two guys have a shootout. Jeremy Renner gets the worst of it. And this woman who he's had a crush on, who he's sort of been in love with throughout the movie, and it's fueled his resentment, this is her final line to him. You know, he's been shot in the head, and they all gather around him, and someone observes he's still sucking wind. And you know, the family is downstairs, and Casey Affleck calls up and says, you know, he has some great line, like, "You can come up and send him on his way," or "Come on up and send him on his way." And this woman just comes up and bends over him and says those things very matter-of-factly. "I'd get you something to drink, but you'd just choke on it." And it's just, you know, it's sort of this, it lays out for the movie, like, how people sort of look at death. And, you know, these are outlaws, and they get in these unglamorous gunfights, and they die horribly, and it's just part of how people pass.
No limbo for them.
That's right.
I really wish I'd chosen that fight for when we did fights.
That fight is just, good Lord, I watched that again, and oh my, it's just spectacular, and in all the ways you don't expect.
Gunfight should be specific, too.
And it's so specific, too. It's so specific, and that these guys have no idea what they're doing. And it's fueled purely on panic and adrenaline. It's just amazing.
I also love how you put it in the true sort of nature of the writing of this movie. You say Jeremy Renner gets the worst of it.
Miners got upset by being made dead by guns.
Hey Tom, what possessed you to climb a roof in December?
Well, there was a cat. What am I saying? There's a cat up there howling and.
Oh, that's a great choice. I love that.
So, all right, that's my number two. Kelly Wand, what is your number two best last line spoken by or to a dying character.
All right, this is for Dingus. This is dedicated to him.
Okay.
I can hold it. No, I'm all... Ah!
So I know what that is. Is it, I can hold it. No, I'm all... Ah! Uh-huh. Is that right?
Yeah.
I regret nothing!
Is it the first... What exactly is the... What's the name of the character who speaks this line, Kelly Wand?
It's a giveaway. Can I
guess the movie?
Yeah.
Is this an Allison Duty joint?
Oh.
What?
No. What are you talking about?
What are you talking about? Even I know it.
What is it?
Dingus, that's for you.
Yeah, it's my Dingus. I'm impressed Tom knows it. I'm sad you don't know it. And I'm much sadder that you don't know it than that Tom does.
Kelly Wand, does the character's name begin with a P?
His last name does.
Do we know his first name?
Yeah, I do.
Because you're...
Yeah.
What's his first name?
Jack.
Good Lord. Wow, you know what? That does sound familiar. Okay.
Uh-huh. Racist.
Dingus, come on. You're breaking our hearts here.
Yeah, this is very bad stuff. I'm sure. You've lost a lot of credibility with this.
Well, at least he didn't say A New Hope.
Oh. Come on, Dingus. Really?
Jack Perkins?
Red 6? Star Wars? He gets killed because there's a little independent feature in French called Star Wars.
His name is Jack Perkins. Why didn't he just eject? They tell him to eject.
He's got too much pride.
Jack's part of his name and he doesn't even... By the way, I always thought because his problem was because he was so overweight that the ship was like flying too low and that's what... Spoiler alert. All right, Perkins gets to go on the internet. And right next to my name.
I am so happy.
Get it.
I'm so relieved that you used a Star Wars quote and not me. I'm so happy. I can't
tell
you.
The best Star Wars quote.
Did you really not recognize that, Dingus?
No.
He acted like he did. And then
I think he's still acting. Dingus.
He's a very skilled actor. But Tom knew it, and Tom doesn't care about that shit.
I think he knew it, and I think he's trolling us, Kelly Wand.
I think he thinks Wendy's listening. He knows Jack Perkins' first name and call something.
How do you know it's Jack? No, I totally didn't. I didn't know what the heck you were talking about.
I can hold it. No, I'm all, you guys thinking.
I thought you were talking about somebody who has to go to the bathroom, and then they rupture.
He was. He did, and it
and that shorted out his R2 unit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't pee in your R2 units.
All right, Dingus, Mr. I don't recognize Star Wars quotes now. What is your number one best last line spoken by or to a dying character?
Don't you have to wait until I actually make my selection before you react that way?
I'm still reacting to you not pretending to not know Jack Porkins' first name.
I didn't know Porkins, and I don't know his first name. I apologize.
But you Porkins. Did know his last line. You did
it's
know his dying word.
And his name's Porkins. What are the odds of that? That's George Lucas.
Thanks, George Lucas.
Thanks, George Lucas. Oh, it's Porkins.
It's like naming a bad character Mal.
Mm-hmm. Or a new character, Neo. Or the small mouse. Remember that guy, the Matrix guy? Just the little one. And you go, Porkins, number two. Dingus is turned.
All right, my number one line spoken by a dying person. I'm sorry, or dying character. Or somebody speaking to them, but this time it's just a dying character. Here goes the line. Our people. I would have followed you, my brother, my captain, my king.
Good Lord, did not do Dead Poets Society.
No, wait, someone said this to me today, even, and I forgot it already.
Say it again, Dingus. Our people, I would have followed you.
My brother, my captain, my king.
It's Dead Poets Society, isn't it?
No. Oh. Wait. Someone
I did not say, oh, captain, my captain. Will you stop saying Dead Poets Society?
That's what I thought it was, too, and it's not. It's,
Oh, I know. Oh, wait. Does Boromir die? Yeah. I mean, is it Boromir's
Boromir.
Dying words?
Right.
Boromir
yes.
dying.
It's not Boromir?
Wait, you're making fun of me for Star Wars and you're pulling that.
Wait, come on. Is that Boromir? I have to know now.
Good. Yes, Tom. Of course it's Boromir.
Sweet.
Ha ha. Dingus says Lord of the Rings. The Porkins of the Lord of the Rings mythos, Boromir.
I love that I got that because I'm trying my best to be a Tolkien dork. I'm really
right.
Tough for me, but I'm trying.
Does he say that in the book?
Yeah, is that a script bit or is that something straight out of the book?
He does a whole poem in the book that goes on for 9 hours, or Aragorn does, doesn't he?
He actually sings a song and they dance during this.
Shut up. You're lying.
Lovely. Tom Bombadil shows up and plays ukulele.
You're such a liar. But Dingus, that is from the book as well.
That's his number one? I'm impressed.
I have no idea if it's from the book. It's from the movie.
It doesn't matter. Source material doesn't matter to Tom.
I'm just curious. Trying to be a Tolkien geek here.
Or a deek, even.
Or a dork.
This is, you know, I feel a little bit guilty about this because I just chose this movie for something a few weeks ago. Best movie ever adapted from something ever.
Right.
And then somebody, I think it was Frank, reminded me of this scene, and I went back and watched it today, and I couldn't stop. I just had to keep watching the scene over and over again. It's gorgeous, It's similar to the Untouchables. It's similar to it, all three scenes have sort of the same, like, sort of comrades in arms kind of feel to them. This one, the other character has something of import to say, you know, and the exchange between Aragorn and Boromir here, is just, what are you laughing about, mister?
I don't know. It's just so nerdy.
I can't help it. It reduces me to tears. And what I didn't expect was watching, and I watched, it's really hard for me not to watch this movie when I put it in and watch a lot of it, is the moment where the horn first sounds. Just all of a sudden, I just got...
Is Wendy in the room when you were doing this?
Oh, of course not.
All right.
Just got totally choked up just at the horn. This is the sound of the horn. And then that moment between Aragorn and Boromir, when Aragorn is just being so gentle to him and you know, telling him how well he fought and say, you know, I do not know what strength is in my blood, but I swear to you, I will not let the White City fall, nor our people fail. And when Boromir hears him say our people, I mean, Boromir feels that he has so failed that only that Aragorn has succeeded where he has failed. And he feels like such a failure here. He feels he's not a man. And Aragorn says, you are a hero and I will take care of your people. And that is just, that's beautiful. And then that moment happens. And then Aragorn tells him to be at peace. It's just, it's beautiful. And it there was another one here, and I'll get to that when we get to our runners up, that this had to supplant because I love the exchange. The exchange here is so personal and intimate. And I just, you know, seeing what he does with that I want to follow you, my brother, my captain, my king, calling him his king. It's just beautiful.
Very nice, Dingus. So I never cry in movies. I'm too tough for that. But if I were to cry in movies, I would cry at that point. Definitely.
Wow.
But I don't, though. That's just for the record.
What if something heavy falls on you while you're watching the movie?
Nope. I don't cry. I'm tough. I'm tough that way.
All right.
I cried during Zapped. Yeah.
But wait, don't spoil your number one, Kelly.
Oh, right. Sorry.
All right. Here's my number one. That's great, Dingus.
It's a high body count in Zapped. Spoiler alert.
My number one. You ready for this? Here's the line. She's probably got wind. Wind her. Put her on your shoulder. Just tap her back. Gently. Gently.
She's got wind. That's a fart joke or a ship.
Do you know, Dingus?
It's Master and
probably.
Commander?
Nope.
She's got wind.
I was actually afraid you might steal this one from me, Dingus. She's probably got wind. Wind her. Put her on your shoulder. Just tap her back. Gently, gently. And then
the yearling?
Do you really not know this one, Dinkus? I'm glad if you don't.
No one expects me to know anything. Not even on the list. Is it old?
No, as a matter of fact, I think all of mine are from the same year.
That's creepy.
No, same 2 years. You know.
Oh. Then that's not interesting.
She's
Red
probably
Leader
not
in Star Wars?
No. Dingus, what were you saying?
Probably got wind.
And she's probably got wind. Say it again, Tom.
She's probably got wind. Wind her. Put her on your shoulder. Just tap her back. Gently. Gently.
Talking to the snowman?
And it's what we've talked about. It's the culmination of this character's arc, like character arc. From the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie, this is, not only are these his dying words, they are basically his redemption. And he's telling a woman how to basically burp a baby.
Huh. Ooh.
Shoot him up.
Close.
the same actor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great one. Wow.
Have you
great. You know, I was looking for something like that where somebody was hiding that they were dying. That's great.
Oh, I know what it is.
Welcome.
Oh, that's good.
Welcome to 30 Seconds Ago, Kelly Wand.
Nominated. Did you say it?
Dingus did, I think.
No, I just did. That's great. Wow, I didn't even think of that.
Because it's all about, I mean, the whole arc of Children of Men. And God, I love that movie. I ended up watching the whole thing again just because I was like, well, I want to see this again. The whole arc of that movie is him sort of recovering his fatherhood. You find out early on about that. And that movie is so good, too, about avoiding conventional exposition. That movie, you have to, it tells you all kinds of things about the world, about the characters, but it never tells them at you. You have to overhear things or see things in the background.
Mm-hmm. And you're with Clive the whole movie, I believe.
Absolutely. Abso-frickin-lutely. Because when he sees what happens to Michael Caine, I remember watching the movie, I'm like, well, wait a minute, we find out what happens to Michael Caine, but Clive Owen's left. It's because he's doubled back to check on him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the movie stays with him the entire time, except perhaps seeing the boat come at the end to rescue the woman. I presume he's dead by that point.
Well, that's his dying hallucination because he's in level 4.
Could be. But that's my number one. As far as like a dying line,
that's a great one.
That really brings a character around and it really
matters. All great movies, except for Star Wars.
Wait, you've still got your number one, Kelly Wand.
Ah, yes.
You could,
I didn't want to cut you off.
You could break the trend here. So far, we've got 8 great movies. Kelly Wand, what are you going to do with your number one best last line spoken by or to a dying character?
Here's the quote. Die. Tom.
Is it a German movie? Because it's pronounced.
I'm upset at Tom. Tom's in trouble now.
Why would I know this? It's one syllable. It's not even a line.
It's come up in the podcast already.
Zap.
Ugh. That's every podcast, not this one.
Don't know. Die? How would I know this?
Because it's the greatest last line in any movie.
To a dying character.
It's said to a dying character.
Who's the dying character?
Who plays him?
Yeah.
Are you doing
Philip Seymour Hoffman?
Yeah.
Doubt?
Ugh. No, it's Cynic Doche.
Yeah.
Oh.
Damn you, Tom.
Wow. Well, you know what? I don't claim to have seen Synecdoche.
Oh shit.
I mean, I've seen it, but I have not. I didn't get it, and I need to watch it again. I make no claims to understanding or being able to appreciate or intelligently discuss Synecdoche, which is not much different.
The last thing he hears is a stage director.
No, I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Over the ear piece. Van Weest, is that who's telling him?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I know.
Best movie ever made. Best movie ever made.
That's a good one, Kelly.
Except for The Untouchables.
That's a good one, and I'll need to see it. Good.
That's why I made the list, so I could say Synecdoche, New York about something, or however you say it. So I could mispronounce Synecdoche.
All right, I need to see that again. Yeah, good. All right, runners up. Dingus, you had some.
Dingus, you had some. Yeah. The Rest is Silence was one that I had.
That's from a play.
Yeah, and that's why I dropped it, because it's been done so many times.
Titanic? The Christopher Durang version? Gotcha.
If we're going to do plays, then I would bring up, in Aleppo once, a turbaned Turk beat a Venetian and traduced the state. I took the circumcised dog by the throat and smote him thus. There you go.
That's Driving Miss Daisy.
See, everyone does Hamlet, but I think the Othello one is better.
Yeah.
Othello's a game. Othello's racist.
My other ones were just silly ones. You know, like, I would like to have seen Montana is one of the ones.
Oh, that's right. Is that Stellan Skarsgård or the Jurassic Park dude, Sam Neill?
It's Sam Neill. I would like to have seen Montana. I also flirted with I Have Been and Always Shall Be Your Friend.
Oh, God.
I'm hearing that, Sally?
Doesn't count because he doesn't stay dead.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's the Wrath of Khan. And then, of course, the very first one that I dropped was tell your sister you were right about me.
Oh.
Tell your sister you were right about me?
Yeah.
Is that Star Wars? Is that Darth Vader's last line?
Yeah, baby.
Good Lord.
They didn't make the list.
Okay. Good.
They made the runners-up list. That's like Killers making the list of Night Day pastiches.
A lot of things made the runners-up list, but those were the ones I thought would amuse you the most.
So here's one that I saw. It's not a movie. It's actually a series of shorts posted on the internet about a guy who, during the act of autoerotic asphyxiation while playing a Zelda game, gets zapped into a Zelda, and it's called Legend of Neil. And in one of the episodes, he befriends an orc who he later kills in a fight. And while the orc is dying, this orc has a son. And while the orc is dying, he says to the hero, "If you see my son, tell him I said to kill you." It's like, hey, that's clever. I'm sure that's been done somewhere else better, but that's clever.
Then he dies,
yeah. So you think it's going to be like a heartfelt, tell my son I loved him, but instead tell my son I said to kill you. Get it?
But then he kills him.
He's already died.
So the son, it's really a red herring. Okay.
No, it's a joke. Hello.
Wow.
That reminds me of Love and Death, when one of the characters is leaving with Death, and he says, "If you see my wife, tell her I'm with you."
No, was it Borat?
It was Borat, yeah. Yes.
I like you. You're my wife. Tell me, what were some of your runners-up?
One of them was blue. No, yellow.
Ah, that's a good one if that stuff isn't all played out for you like it is for me. Good, good.
It's played out, but if you just take it by itself, it's funny. Like, it's a funny way to end your life.
And that's from Holy Grail, of course. I just can't imagine.
I think you're five and you've never seen it. It's a funny line. You can make that leap.
Let me run, go wake up my son.
And now you just see it and you go, yeah, it's that part where it's the thing. But the first time you heard it was funny, wasn't it?
Yep.
Because it's so stupid to not remember your... Never mind. And, like, that character wasn't even set up as stupid.
Now go ahead and explain the joke to us, Kelly Wong, just to be safe. Go ahead.
No, forget it. I'm not going to talk about Holy Grail on the podcast.
Kelly Wong, can you do verbatim any other great Monty Python bits?
No. But I have another runners-up.
Okay, what do you got?
I said I was a count, not a saint.
Hmm.
Oh.
Is that from Sesame Street?
I'll give you a hint. Count is part of the title of the movie.
Count Dracula.
All right.
What? Is that wrong? I don't know. Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah, good. See, you know lions. You know Alexandre Dumas.
Is that the one? Isn't James Caviezel in A Count of Monte Cristo?
Yeah. Is you don't like Jim Caviezel now? You gonna hate on him?
No, I like. Is
this
he's
going? Jesus.
It's Jesus.
True.
Yeah.
That's my favorite Mel movie. Back before, and he dresses like a pig in Heat. Crazy. Spoiler alert.
Crucify me, but you're gonna blow me first.
Yeah. It all adds up. If you see that movie, you'll understand where Mel's coming from with the whole pig and heat thing. You go, ah.
I really love. If you have more runners up, that's cool, Kelly. I just can't get over how great a choice Children of Men is, because I kept racking my brain over ones where a character was dying but was not letting on, and I had one on the edge of my brain of this. It was a bad movie, though, where a guy, like, has totally hidden that he's dying, and then he goes into this warehouse, and he dies, and I can't remember what it was, but I love that choice of Children of Men, because I couldn't think of any others like that.
What's the one where the guy goes in the warehouse?
I can't remember. It's not a very good movie. I just he like rescues somebody and he sends her on her way or sends him on his way. I can't remember enough, but I remember him going in there and then it's revealed that he's been shot and he falls down and the movie might even cheat and save him. But I love that idea of the character hiding the fact that they're dying.
Because she freaks out and thinks that she's bleeding, and he reassures her. He never shares it. It's that she's worried that she's hurt. And he's like, no, you're okay. It's not you. You know, it's me. Because I don't think he's going to say anything about it. Yeah, and I hate to keep poor Inception, but the thing is, I had just watched Children of Men, and the action sequences in Children of Men, I think, just are, to this day, it's what, 3-4 years old, are just unparalleled. I mean, the way Cuarón, I hope I'm saying his name right, just shot those action sequences as one take, that stuff is just amazing.
Wait, I said that on a 3x3, and you mocked me once.
Not for Children of Men, are you serious?
Yeah, the car part. Referred to as like the best thing that happens in a car, and you went, yeah. What I meant by the list was
your impression of Tom is spot on.
That's good, Kelly Wand. That's eerie to hear that.
Yeah.
Wait, I'm right here.
Talk. I know. I'll try to nail that Arkansas accent. I had watched Cormac McCarthy interviews for a few hours.
Dingus, what is our 3x3 for next week? What do you got for? That's a tough act to follow. That one was a really good one, Kelly Wand. I know you're often hard on yourself for your 3x3s, but good Lord, that was a great one.
The listeners will make it good.
And there's great, post in the thread some of y'all's picks. I imagine there'll be some great ones to come. But we've hogged up, I think, the 9 best.
The best one wins a prize. Oh, never mind.
You were gonna...
a really cool prize to give away.
What is it?
It's a Green Lantern script written by Robert Smigel. The guy who does Triumph. It's like a comedy Green Lantern script.
You're just going to give this to someone?
Well, we're going to have a contest so people care about the podcast more. It's promotional.
I think the prize should be you reading the script to them.
Like an audio and doing voices.
That's a prize? That's a boogie prize. All right, never mind. Just forget I said anything.
So those of you listening, there might be a contest down the road. You could win this Robert Smigel.
We'll figure out how later.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 3 or 4 weeks somehow.
All right, so Dingus, what do you got for us for the next 3x3? I don't envy you having to follow this one.
Mm. Yeah, you never envy me having to follow Kelly Wand. And
I'm so glad it works out that way.
Lovely. I wonder who set this up. All right, I watched quite a number of films this week in preparation for our little podcastery, and this thing happened a couple of times, and one time in particular, it really knocked me out, and all of a sudden, today's 3x3 popped into my head, and this is our top 3 trapped underwater moments.
Oh,
this is not. I'm not talking about Rain. I'm talking about Submerged, so don't try to do Rain. So your top three.
I'm talking about the game. Talking about practice.
Three, right, trapped underwater moments.
Should we take some off the table? Because now I'm worried. Let's see. So I'll be going first. So if I pick the one everybody's now thinking of for my number 3, I'll scoop you guys. Okay, so I think I'm okay with this.
Yeah, I still have a couple to take off the table.
Good. I can think of a lot of crappy ones.
Do whatever you want to do. Okay. I'm not taking anything off the table. Do whatever you want to do. And
define
and,
trap. Define moments. Define podcast.
Why do you use the word trapped? Why do you say you feel trapped in the body of a woman?
Oh, what's that from?
When Harry Met Sally. Actually, is that true? I just made that up. I don't know if that's true.
The next line is, sometimes I get the menstrual cramps real hard.
Good Lord, what is that from? It's with Michael Clark Duncan. Armageddon?
You're such a racist. It is not Michael Clark Duncan. It is Raising Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Racist.
Raising Arizonaist.
So should we take like the one that we're all thinking of off the table?
Arizona's
just
racist.
Do it?
What do you want to take off the table?
Take off the table. Alien Resurrection?
Is this
too
like
obvious?
Seeing a jury? Should I give you guys one thing to strike?
Okay, then no. You know what? Never mind. I'm going first, so maybe I'll just pick the one everybody's...
What is it? Oh, I know.
It rhymes with rabiss.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Mine rhymes with Maviathan.
Mine rhymes with most MIP.
What? Most MIP.
Hey, does it count if the fish is eating like your underwater vehicle and then a bigger fish eats it? Is that trapped underwater?
Top three trapped underwater moments.
All right, good. That works for me. All right, so let's see Salt next week. Philip Noyce directed.
Sounds spicy.
Very good. I believe it's a Tony Gilroy script. I could be wrong.
Oh, I didn't know Philip Noyce directed it. Okay, now I feel better.
Yeah, yeah. There's two good reasons right there to see it.
Plus Angelina Jolie's boobs. There's four.
What? I have no idea what you're talking about, but we'll find out. So join us for that next week, as well as our 3x3, top three trapped underwater moments. I am Tom Chick. I am here with Christian McCracksky. Christian McCracksky.
It's Christian Morosky. Come back to reality, Tom, please.
And Kelly Wand.
Because she has boobs. I think that's enough of that, right?